Hey, Matthew here. Scaffold is on holiday this week, so I thought I'd put an old episode down the feed. This is my interview with the designer Asif Khan from April 2022. Hope you enjoy it, and I'll be back again next week with a new episode. Just get you to clip this to your
shirt.
Mm-hmm. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold.
It's okay outside.
For this episode, I thought I'd try something different. It's an interview that doubles as a kind of studio tour of my guest this week, Asif Khan, who designs buildings, landscapes, exhibitions, and installations.
Okay, you're just putting it there.
Khan's practice is versatile and resists classification. His commissions, which often include experimental, groundbreaking pavilions, work really shrewdly with technology to develop new experiences and environments. A breakout project of his from 2014, for example, involved this billboard of three-dimensional pixels that projected a changing topography of faces. Even his larger and more conventional projects, like the renovation of Smithfield Market to house the new Museum of London, feels visionary and unorthodox in its anticipation of how it might be further altered and developed by future generations. Khan is interested in the depth and vastness of time, and his influences include the likes of Buckminster Fuller and Kenzo Tange, and the hybrid practices of Charles and Ray Eames and Ken Yahara. His work feels elastic, ambitious, and visionary in a way that's unconcerned with what might be considered good taste. Khan's approach to architecture really seems like it's entirely his own. We began our conversation in a corner of the warehouse that's been turned into the studio library, where he shared a few books with me that have left a mark on him and show how he thinks about design.
So the library, we have about 1,000 books now. They're not all here, but I don't know, what is it, 800 or 900 here. What you'll see is very little theory here, because I have a pet hate for architectural theory. So yeah, there are things about design theory here, but not works by, you know, there's a little bit of space, time, and architecture is here, I think, and a couple of others, but more things like Christopher Alexander. I think like what I've always tried to do is to have a really broad range of influences in my work. It's really helpful to have a common frame of reference as well in the studio, however broad. Like there's a book here about, you know, knots, or there's a book here about palm trees, or the Muji catalog, or you know, books about spacesuits. It's quite a mixture, but it's a kind of work in progress. Yeah, process of learning, really.
You did a foundation course, right, where you're learning more about woodworking and materials and craft work in general. Could you tell me about that?
So it was this small foundation course, because I wanted to go to like St. Martin's or something, but I was too late to apply. And this was like a course run by the Prince of Wales. There were like 18 students, and the course had been running for like 10 years. And I was really skeptical about the whole thing when I heard about it. I was like, oh god, that sounds really fuddy-duddy, and it's not like cool. I want to go somewhere and do film and this. And it turned out to be the most incredible and relevant mixture of education that I could have. I think it's still like that year that I was there. If I could freeze that and give that to every architect student, every design student, you know, as a kind of background for their lives, I would do it. It's just amazing. And we learnt about, of course, all the, like the history and the, and you know, classical orders and all the things you'd expect, but also learnt to carve with wood, stone carving, metalwork. The first week we made a yurt, you know, a week later we made a geodesic dome out of bamboo. Keith Critchlow taught us, who was a, you know, one of the proteges of Buckminster Fuller.
Yes,
you know, he was in his like 70s and he taught us, and I think he's passed away now, but he was like a, you know, I guess having that synthesis of like new age thinking and like structural engineering and all that, all of the stuff that you'd hear about from the Whole Earth catalog.
Yes.
It felt that there were the glowing embers of that still in that school, if you knew where to look. Mm-hmm. And we learned fine art and did all the oil painting and all of that stuff. And you know, it was just amazing.
Mm. I mean, just for listeners who might not be familiar with some of these references, Critchlow was into this idea of sacred geometry. So you mentioned like new age thinking, and you talk about the Whole Earth catalog. Yeah. Again, this project that came out of California, I think in the 1960s.
We have one of the last issues. Stuart Brand was the publisher, and it's a sort of pre-internet. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to sort of connect together. They called it like a tool. They called the book a tool, basically. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to connect together thinking and suppliers sort of designs for a potential future that would be better. Mm-hmm. Like on the front was an image of the Earth. The pages were like the yellow pages, if you know, which are just like really cheap paper stock. It's a catalog, but you'd leaf through and you'd find on one page there'd be like instructions on building guitars, and the next page would be instructions for building your own shelter, and you know, the next page might be something about meditation or about how to do agriculture, like the early kind of aspects of the kind of organic movement, or you know, it was all there. I don't know how much they published it, but it was enormously influential.
I mean, there's a real sense of restlessness and unbridled optimism and utopianism that I also feel when I see a lot of the work you've made as a designer. And I say designer because it's more than architecture in a way. Yeah. It's this expanded idea of what architecture is. But so why, after this foundation course, did you decide to go into architecture?
I think I didn't decide to go into architecture, but I decided that I wanted to continue that to the educational pathway. And I felt that Bartlett, for me at the time, was just like presented like this synergetic thinking opportunity.
It's another Buckminster Fuller term.
That is a Buckminster, intentional Buckminster Fuller term. I felt I needed to be in a really creative environment where anything goes. And that was what, surprisingly, the Prince's Foundation gave me. There was no pressure to become an architect, really. And in fact, I remember when I left, my tutors said, "We really think you should go into film." And it was just, I was like, wow, I hadn't really thought of that. And they said, "There's something about the way you are, like editing your." So like if I was painting or drawing, I'd like focus in on like micro details. They were more about the kind of atmosphere of a moment, like trying to express some sort of micro world with an atmosphere, rather than to objectively represent something.
I mean, I'm just remembering now slides you've shown in other presentations about work you've done with students while you're teaching, where maybe this isn't work by you, but work that's kind of representative of the kind of interest that you're explaining here. You'll take like a loaf of sourdough bread and start to populate a section of it with little figures, or like put a droplet of water on a tiny human figure. Or you're starting to understand the microscopic world as a space of imagination.
Yeah.
When you talk about cinema, I immediately think of designers like Charles and Ray Eames and their interest in these vast extremes of our capacity to think and imagine, from the cosmic right down to the microscopic. And I'm thinking of Powers of Ten, their film in particular. But I think before we go down this,
it's one of my favorite,
this route of influences, I think you mentioned that for you, coming out of this foundation course, in thinking about architecture as a discipline where anything could happen or you could do anything, as set up or established by the kind of self-initiative or do-it-yourself attitude that the Whole Earth Catalog embodied. Mm. I really feel like the studio itself that we're in right now exemplifies that in a way. And I want to just wander around it with you for a bit and give listeners an idea of where exactly we are right now. Okay. So we're in like an old, it looks like an old warehouse.
Yeah, this used to be a carpet warehouse. We're in East London, just near Broadway Market, an area that's gone through rapid change. And some areas you could say are like, have become gentrified, but a lot of the original residents are still here. Opposite our studio is a big housing estate, Peabody Housing Estate. On the left of our studio is a kind of MMA gym, focusing on jiu-jitsu. On the right is a publisher of children's books. So it's like, it's kind of quite a mix. There's a coffee roastery at the end. It's a classic kind of gentrification symbol.
Right, there goes the neighborhood.
Australian coffee brand. But it's really interesting. Like, it's in any day in front of the studio, the people sitting on our wall will be kids getting ready for their jiu-jitsu class, or old men, Bangladeshi men, kind of taking a rest as they walk to get the groceries. And it's always different here. And that was quite, I think for me, like, quite a conscious decision of like, the studio should be in a place that feels real. And it's inspiring in that respect. That life flows around it. And inside, it should also feel true to the nature of the process, and sort of unedited, and true to the nature of the way I think, and I kind of want to help other people think.
Well, let's talk more about that. So we're standing close to the, well, I guess we'll go up to the entrance.
Yeah.
So there's a bank of large windows and a frosted glass door, and we're looking down to the end of the warehouse, and we can see between us and the end there are shelves of models. There are large one-to-one scale mock-ups of strange objects. There are giant prints of past work you've done. And then at the end, there are people at a long table bathed in top light and shaded by these strange canvas canopies that are kind of drooping above them.
Yeah, and looking down, all of these masking tape lines are also mock-ups of all manner of things, from the shape of rooms that we're designing, or the pattern on the floor, tiling layouts, staircase, staircase treads.
Oh, this is so interesting. I can see a tracing of one project in particular, the Hyundai Pavilion.
Yeah, that's
at the, this is the, oh God,
the it's Winter the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics.
The Pyeongchang Winter Olympics Pavilion you made.
Yeah,
so this is a ghost of a project that's inscribed on the floor in masking tape.
Yeah, this is, I can take you through them actually.
Sure.
So this one here is the monument to workers. This is the floor, the layout of the monument to workers that we just did at the Dubai Expo, these kind of zigzagging lines. This bit here, if we turn orientation, is a bit of the staircase, the main staircase from the Museum of London, which we were testing in different sizes. So this is like a 4 or 5 meter width check. Some of these lines are actually a kind of expansion of the Hyundai project into a larger public space work that we did. What else do we have here?
But basically, what it's saying is this is a place where things are tested at one to one.
Yeah, that was so. That was like a really important learning from the Prince's Foundation. It's like, basically, you've got to make things. You've got to feel them out. You've got to understand things at true scale. And I think we've always, I've strived to, and in the studio, we've always tried to balance the work that we're doing on the computer and on sketches and in renders and whatever we're doing there with physical full-scale prototypes of things. Mm. And it's not that we're not really making final outputs. Mm-hmm. We're using the made object as a living sketch. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is a piece of staircase.
It's a mock-up of a timber stair turning a corner.
It's a particular junction in the Museum of London that is really tricky to resolve.
Huh.
And you can stare at a computer screen for days and you'll never figure it out. So this was made by Izzy, who's our head of making here. And she was trying to figure out different ways, essentially, of supporting the staircase and how you deal with this junction where like six or seven pieces of timber all come in together and have to resolve in one place. And you know, how do you sort of make them? And it's the kind of this question, which is like the perennial question of like architects or designers for hundreds of years, is like junction. How do materials meet?
Uh-huh.
And when they meet, what does it say? Mm. You know, like that's the. So we do a lot of that, and we'll bring the client to look at it. We'll bring engineers to look at it. And say, hey, we figured it out actually, and they'll come say, oh, you know, that's impossible. Mm-hmm. No, we proved it. It is possible. Mm. So it's really useful for that sense. It allows to speak the same language.
Uh huh. It seems like such an obvious way of solving a detailed problem, but at the same time, very expensive and laborious and time consuming. But I mean, would you agree, or like, how can you afford to have a head of making in the practice who's constantly mocking up one-to-one scale models of details like this?
Well, it's challenging to, yeah, how to say, like, it's an expensive thing to do, and the burden of that cost is on us.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always been a feeling that the for me that the you can't really rely on the computer to tell you the truth, and you can't rely on the translation from the computer or drawing board even to the site. To the site, or to the workshop, to the final output, to match what you had in your mind at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So what this thing does is it ensures that what we say it is what it is, right? And so I see like the process of designing as a kind of pledge that you make with a site or a client or a community, and everything that we say at the beginning in that pledge, I want to truthfully deliver upon. And I've just found by building as part of the design process, as you know, we're able to get. Although you know, architecture is not a direct art form, it requires so many hands, so much reinterpretation, and kind of deviations from where you start off. By doing this, it gets you a little bit closer to the sort of immediacy that an artist has on their art form, you know, on the canvas. We're able to jump forward a few steps, have the immediacy here, and then use that as the mock-up. And I think you see it in, you know, if we were to go to India, Pakistan, or East Africa, you know, where my mum is from, you'd see people doing that normally as part of like a process. Mm-hmm. The contractor would build you, hey, is this how you want the wall to be done? But here it tends to be done in paperwork, and I think that's a very challenging and like arcane way of translating what should be touched and felt and seen. You know?
It's so interesting, your allegiance to reality and material honesty, given a lot of the work you do is, to me, almost unreal. It's so imaginative and so experimental. And I think it's helpful just to read a description of an archive of your work to give a sense of what I mean when I say that. So you've designed a building that can be played like a musical instrument. You've designed a screen that is made of three-dimensional pixels, which project a changing topography of faces. You've made a project that projects a circadian cycle on a cylindrical screen to sound works by the composer Brian Eno. A towering gateway made of a complex lattice of black scaffolding. I'm just gonna keep going. A building made of the darkest, or the most light absorbent material in the world, with a 3D star field mapped onto its facade. And inside that building, you've designed a white hydrophobic interior that animates the movement of water droplets. I mean, the list just goes on and on. All this stuff, I think...
All built here, by the way.
But I couldn't have imagined in my wildest dreams, and yet you have the physical artifacts of their making in the studio. I think that's really interesting. that this kind of radical imagination starts with a very concrete and physical process of mocking it up.
The amazing thing to draw from that is we've proven it's possible. you can imagine pretty much anything you want, and it will be possible to make it if you go through a process of testing and prototyping that you're in control of.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, there's so much here. I mean, it's overwhelming. We could spend a full day just in this bank of shelving with all kinds of models and prototypes on them. But I want to actually explore the rest of the studio with you. So we're passing the shelves, passing the library.
This is sort of an area for dry model making, mm-hmm. With card and paper. Every instrument that you'd want. There's like 20 different tweezers.
Oh my God.
In these drawers. this is sort of my heaven.
Wow. So what was
heaven on earth? This is for picking up microscopic bits of model, okay, and placing them. I mean, this is like an extension of like when I was a kid, doing Airfix models, or this little Games Workshop Warhammer type things. Mm-hmm. It was all about the miniature, and this. All of these tools are about sort of the miniature world. Mm. If we go over here, this is like this long kind of stick table is where we work. We had this original idea that we should have no screens. Everyone should work on laptops. It's like right from the beginning, mm-hmm. so that people can see each other.
Right, and we're talking quite loudly in front of about 10 or 15 people working hard at this long table, studiously avoiding our gaze.
The idea was always, and we had the same in our old office, was that what we also have done here is like this half of the studio has like a kind of alter ego on the other side. Mm.
Okay, so we're going through a corridor now.
So in the middle is a meeting room, which is like...
Right, and there's a polycarbonate roof with a steel truss that's holding it up, and just a big stick frame table and a giant... flat screen TV in the middle of it.
So here we do pinups and meetings and so on. When we work on a competition, this is like the nerve center of that competition.
Mm, so like, right.
You remember this film Beautiful Mind? And he's like, yeah, right. Yeah. It's like that's what it looks like. In here. This is quite nice.
This is like a cabinet of curiosities now.
Yeah, like things that like we've made that like. Why don't you just keep around, you know, just...
This is, you're holding a, like, tensile metal and fishing wire structure?
We actually ended up making an electric guitar using that structure, a Fender. You've got, like, a bit of this Vanta Black for different samples. That was the first sample they gave me back, years ago when I visited their factory.
Wow. So Vanta Black is that... dark material we were talking about earlier, the most light absorbent material.
These are casts of the shape of your hand. So we were working a project to think about like a what would be the perfect mirror, and this idea that a mirror could be held in the palm of your hand just fits into all of the kind of
oh my god
the space.
So it looks like these are flat, almost like flat white stones laid out on a glass shelf, and you just put one on your hand, and it looks like a puddle of something being cupped in your hand, and it's formed precisely to the contour of your palm. Let's just keep going. I see behind you a climbing wall in another room.
Okay. So this space is our kind of, say, fabrication space. Izzy is sitting over there, who's our head of making.
Hi, Izzy.
Who's a very talented maker across many different mediums and scales. And
we're just to kind of paint the picture, we're standing inside of half of the room, which is closed off by a black velvet curtain. And the walls are faceted timber with a bunch of climbing holds on them.
Yeah, well, this is a lockdown project. This space has always been for making. And when we had half of the studio space, and when this became available, we kind of asked to take this on as well, because the project's got, they needed more full-size mock-ups, like bits of auditorium seating for Museum of London, or here, what's in front of us is a bit of a bridge that we're doing in Canada Water.
Right, so there's a giant timber mock-up right in front of us. It looks like a giant balustrade.
We can climb on it.
Actually. Okay, cool.
So we're standing on a on this bridge, and we're really interested in, you know, what it feels like to be here. So we have things like this bridge, and we test it full size for lots of different things, the feel and the proportions and so on. But also around it, this climbing wall, this lockdown project, the idea was all the climbing centers were closed and my kids were really into climbing. And we said, okay, well, let's just build a small climbing wall so they can do some climbing during lockdown. Uh-huh. And so I had an idea of like 3 meters wide and we'll just put some holes in it. And it got bigger and bigger. And then, you know, because I knew that lots of people in the studio climb, we just said, you know, let's just make it the whole of the wall.
It's the whole room, and even onto the ceiling as well.
Yeah. And it became this huge project, actually. And it allowed us to get our teeth into something. And Izzy, got this machine, which is this big CNC machine. And it really was a chance to create a new sort of recreational space in the studio that everyone can use. Climbing is such a strangely such a perfect sport or activity for designers and architects who you spend your day thinking spatially in your head, but like climbing allows you to think spatially to externalize those spatial thoughts. And it's a very mindful activity, as well as being like really hard.
It's amazing to see. What it also is reminding me of, in a way, is how the culture of work has changed so fundamentally, and how typically, maybe in larger companies, and even maybe originally in tech companies, spaces of entertainment, recreation, and leisure start to make their way into the office, and they are enjoyable amenities, but they also extend the amount of time that employees stay in the office itself. So there's a difficult question here about what work means in this environment. And I imagine, like, with all these incredible mock-ups and all the iteration that goes on and all the study and testing, that this is not your typical quote-unquote 9-to-5 job. And just tell me your thoughts on that, on working culture in general. And just to be clear, I mean, most architecture practices are, architecture as a discipline is notorious for long hours.
You know what I'd say? So here's my reflection on it, is that architecture is one of the most difficult tasks that you can put your mind to. It's the most challenging art form. It's always been said to be. It really is. And it requires, to do it well, it requires an enormous amount of time and effort, because it's made it requires a consideration of materials, cost, manufacturing, three-dimensional space, junctions between maybe a million elements to be considered, right? Mm. Mm. So the kind of and the kind of coordination of so many experts and the information they produce, and all that information to be held by two or three people or five people on the architect side. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're, apart from like a governance or something, running a country, I don't think there are many situations one would find yourself in where like so much information had to be filtered through a very small number of people mm-hmm. to make a decision, right? And mm-hmm. I think people underestimate how difficult architecture is to do well. What could happen is if people paid a lot of money for you to do architecture well, but this just doesn't happen. It may have happened at some point in time, we have this idea of it, and it may happen sometime in the future. It doesn't happen now. So what that means is you can't have a huge team doing that stuff and therefore reduce a burden on people. Mm. If you want to do this thing well, you just have to extend how much time you work. And that's there is no getting out of it. Mm. You can't rely, if you rely on the computer too much to reduce that burden, the work gets worse. If you rely on the contractor too much to reduce that burden, the work gets worse. If you don't make these prototypes, good luck on what turns up on site, you know, because someone mm-hmm. else is going to figure it out. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge is it's this struggle between is architecture worth it? Is our built environment worth it? If we don't do the work and produce things of quality, will someone else do it? Who's responsible for that, for the bit of right? Who's responsible for what gets out there? I think the architects in the world who are striving to take that responsibility, it's a heavy burden, and the burden goes on them and their teams. And the result is cities are better places, but it's an enormous burden. Mm. Similarly, like a surgeon isn't a 9-to-5 job, mm. but they save lives, you know? And I think an operation happening in the middle of the night is normal, matter of course, for them. And they're not mm. remunerated very well for it, in the UK at least. So it's a really challenging situation, I think. But this moment in time, we are thinking more about how to make this process more efficient. Mm. And we're thinking more about what we can learn from other industries and how we can, give more rest to people. So for example, everyone has a Friday afternoon they can take, or everyone has an afternoon they can take off one day a month as a, they can choose where it is. Mm. Like, I want to take a Friday afternoon off, you can do it, mm. it's included. Mm. We have in the summer like more flexible working hours, so some people will come in earlier and leave earlier because the light's better and so mm-hmm. on. We're really open now to taking people's perspectives of how to get the most out of themselves, but without compromising their health or something. So these are conversations that weren't happening before, and mm. I think these are in any practices, and I think these are. These are things that we're learning about today.
Just to kind of, I'm a signpost. We've left the climbing wall area. We're on the other side of the black curtain, and we're in what looks like another fabrication space. There's a big model behind us of what I think is the project in Kazakhstan.
Yeah, this is the Selini. Selini Center for Contemporary Culture in Kazakhstan.
And what right now we're kind of we're segueing into a different conversation, which is about the practice structure mm-hmm. and how, as you were saying, It's less hierarchical or more horizontally organized. Could you talk more about that? Because yeah. I think it's interesting with practices like this that do have quite a strong identity and do have one person's name on the front of the door. What it means to start to work in a non-hierarchical way, and how other people's identities or attitudes start to feed into the practice.
Yeah, I'm conscious of this will be my perspective as the leader of the studio. And the leader saying it's non-hierarchical it sounds like a paradox. What I'm trying to say is, we've never put a limit on what someone's potential is. So in architecture we have these classifications like part one, part two, part three, IRBA experience plus 5 years, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't care what someone's qualifications are. If they're amazing and they're part one, they could be having more responsibility in delivering a bigger project than a registered architect with 5 years experience.
Would they be making the same amount of money though?
Yeah, they'd be making more than the qualified architect. Mm. If they had some incredible aptitude and ability to speak to people, ability to explain ideas, explain how to build things. Mm. And we've done that in the past. So we've done, you know, so our project lead for the Expo 2020 was a part two, who was responsible for delivering 6 kilometers of public realm in a country that he had never been to, but had kind of gained the respect of the client and contractors. Mm. And the other architects we were collaborating with ACOM and Foster's and ASGG and Grimshaw and Hopkins. This one guy brought something totally unexpected to the mix.
Mm. What was his name?
I don't remember.
Oh, right.
I'm just kidding. His name was Masayuki Sato. So he's Japanese guy. But it's an example. And Masa now is in Australia. He's going to try and set up a kind of a, we called it like a Asia Pacific zone for us, so like a studio. But you know, he's like 30 years old and he was like running this enormous project. So I don't really believe in all these qualifications. At the same time, I've just met young people who are capable of enormous things and very experienced people who are capable of nothing.
That's so refreshing to hear. And especially in the context of how I think rigidly controlled the title of architect is in this country, where the ARB, the Architects Registration Board, routinely set out to find people who call themselves architects but aren't on their register and then kind of publicly shame them. And
I'm not on the register.
Right. So that's interesting.
I never took my part three.
So tell me about that decision not to do the part three, which for listeners outside of the UK is the kind of final stage of licensure before you can call yourself an architect. Why not do that?
I mean, at the beginning, I wanted to, but just didn't have time to. I went to the Bartlett first, then the AA. When I finished the AA, I went straight into a project, actually, in like this West Beach cafe. Actually, I worked for my ex-tutor for like a bit of time, like a few months, and then this project kind of came online. I did it. I wanted to find time to do part three, and I never could fit it in. The studio kind of got busier, and then we started employing architects. And at that point, it doesn't matter so much because if you have 5 architects on your team or 10 architects on your team, you are essentially an architecture studio, right? Mm-hmm. I think you need a minimum of, there is a minimum number. That's for those of you who want to set up practices on this, who are listening, to call yourself an architect studio. I think you need 3, something like that. But yeah, it just wasn't important. And I kind of, at the same time, there's something I've always liked about not being about people not calling you something, because once you get called something, you get categorized in a certain way. It sort of excludes other aspects of your of yourself.
This is interesting. So this is something we started talking about before recording, but the way in which it's very difficult actually to pigeonhole your practice or you as a designer, because your background is in architecture, but the work you do bridges everything from product design to exhibition design to conceptual furniture to large-scale master planning. There's this one project which is a favorite of mine where you infused soap bubbles with helium to create a canopy of clouds as a shade device. So I mean, like, it ranges so dramatically that in a way there is no title, which is its own kind of problem. Or what do you, another way of putting that is, what do you call yourself? A designer?
Not really. I also don't. It's really difficult. I mean, I think what tends to happen is other people will call you a designer or an architect or an artist. And when you try to call yourself something, they'll tell you, no, you're not, you're this. I've done a lecture, and I remember doing a lecture, and someone afterwards came and told me, oh, I understand now, you're an artist. That's what you are. And at once it feels like you want to argue with them, and at the other time it feels that you are glad that someone has spotted some aspect of yourself that you'd like to be out there.
Difficulty of not being able to place you. And it's not that I necessarily want to, or I want to find some kind of title, but I think what I'm interested in is how that influences the way you or your practice is received by a public. And I get the feeling that Asif Khan is more recognizable in a way abroad than the practices in the UK. I might be wrong about that, but I know a lot of the work is more international. It's more, a lot of the more significant projects, aside from the Museum of London, are in places further afield, whether it's in Dubai or Kazakhstan or elsewhere. And so also I think myself, having spent 7 years in London, and having become steeped in a certain kind of culture of architecture, to me, your practice is an outlier in a really exciting way. And I want to understand what your relationship is to architecture in the UK and architecture in London specifically, how you situate yourself in the context of London architecture practices, I guess.
It's a great question.
There's a more precise way of asking it.
I understand what you're getting at.
But I think
it's,
I wanna,
like, who the hell are you?
No, but I think I want to try and articulate it in a way that
it's
people could understand.
Who are you? It's not even who are.
But it's like, yeah. I think that, yeah, to me, the kind of standard approach to architecture, the accepted approach to architecture, especially in the UK, has to do with drawing on influences within the discipline. And so there's this real interest in historic precedent in architecture that's about architecture, that sees itself in this lineage of other architects and is slowly evolving, but in what to me is actually quite a conservative way. I mean, even now, still in London, architects fetishize bricks. And they fetishize, rightly so, but still
arches.
There's a formal language that I think we've developed a consensus about as being in good taste.
Yeah. I think firstly, the idea that you would look upon other people's work as a reference point for your own, and particularly of your peers, or like let's say the to me that feels like a very strange way of working. It's okay to look, let's say, into the deep past or kind of a global perspective, but it felt like I really love this question. I just want to kind of I need to tease it out, but it's like okay, my dad is from Pakistan. He's an immigrant, you know, came to the UK early 60s and got himself an education and so on, and really in one generation transformed himself from a kind of farm living in tiny farm and looking after two cows to getting a history and politics degree and sort of expanding his mind to the entire world, right? My mother, East African Indian, also went through the same process. Small town, Iringa in East Africa, came to the UK and went to university and just transformed, I think, her perspectives from life. They both became social workers, very modest people. They work with people who work with people. But they had global perspectives, and they had it from their history, from the challenging backgrounds they had, you know, and I'm sure many families have challenges, but also there was a moment in time, I think, in the 60s and 70s, and I talked earlier about the whole Earth Catalogue, where things felt more connected, even though we're more connected now. And I think that really rubbed off on me. So I've never seen like London as the size of the pond. Mm-hmm. It's always felt like, you know, and I had relatives who lived in Canada or Pakistan or India or East Africa or elsewhere that you'd always hear stories about, whatever. So there was always this idea that you can have a multi-layered, multi-dimensional identity. I have no problem with that. I use many operating systems. It's fine. Like I can live with that. Oh yeah, go on. Yeah.
I'm okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah, yeah.
Like a sandwich or something.
Good. Thank you.
Oh, the dal is really good. Take a dal. Yeah. Yeah, dal. Yeah. Dal. Have dal.
Okay, I'll have a dal. Thank you.
So. I practice in a way that is all it is who I am, right? That's all I can give. That's all I can give that's different. That's the only thing that makes sense to me is for me to just give myself into it. And therefore it's inevitable that the way I think about the world is in some way reflected in the way I think about the practice and where I practice. So when opportunities come up in, you know, on the other side of the world, I'm fascinated by the possibilities of that rather than being scared by the risk of it. Mm. When those opportunities come up, I think about what I can bring with my history to connect dots together for those communities that haven't necessarily been connected before because of the perspective of being an outsider, a perspective that you can't give always as an insider in London, right? You just tend to repeat here, right? But I love being an outsider. Saying it affords you a perspective And it affords you a chance to reflect on yourself and your relationship with the world around you, but also to have the people you're working with or for reflect on themselves. So everyone is in a process of kind of self-transformation. Mm. And that's why I like those kind of fresh spaces to work within. Mm. Because we all gain something intellectually from the process. And I think through that, architecture gains something by being moved on like a step. I don't feel it's worth doing something. I've always felt that there's a million good architects in the world, and as you know, any project can be done and the result will be fine and it's okay. Mm. And there's almost no point in competing with those people because it doesn't matter which one you use. It's all going to be fine, okay?
It's interesting though, because again, before we started recording, you mentioned going into a restaurant down the street and seeing the folks from Caruso St. John across the way, and you were in direct competition with them for the Museum of London project. And I think when you say those people, we're probably talking about practices like that, which are maybe less so now, but of working in the context of London, mm-hmm. and then continental Europe as well. And there's a whole tradition that practices like that draw on, which are understandably, for obvious reasons, very rooted in the history of European architecture.
Hmm. Yeah, it's inevitable to look at those things. I have huge respect for what they do, actually. But London is an incredibly diverse place. And it's full of enormous wealth of talent in the kind of creative fields, of which there are many, many fields, right? So you can't help but be inspired by this kind of energy that happens here. But I've found it the way that architecture is practiced here, I feel is, it comes with sort of inbuilt restrictions that I don't really understand how they came about. And we can argue like, okay, it came about because of the developer or the you know, because of planning or because of, you know, capitalism or whatever. But whatever it is, and you mentioned it, they're there, and it's and the conversation is really small, and it's really conservative. So even if you just got a bit of inspiration from the other creative people in London, I think the city would look like a more creative place, a place that inspired people. You know, it changes the way people think and feel and whatever. I feel incumbent on architects to try and, you know, catch those flavors in their work. But maybe they feel they can't. But I think they can. You know, if they look deeper.
In a way, I feel like architecture, as much as it's judged by the public, is judged by its peers. And I feel like there's almost this understanding of what's good and what's proper and what's acceptable. We were talking about before, in terms of material, in terms of formal and historical reference, that you're just totally obliterating or have absolutely no, you're not concerned with. You might still reference these things, but at the same time, you'd be as eager to collaborate with material scientists and technologists and historians and artists quite instinctively and freely. I just want to list off a few influences of yours who fall into this category or situation, mm-hmm. of being somehow peripheral to or operating at the fringes of architecture. So Kenzo Tang, Vladimir Shukov, Joseph Paxton. I mean, to that point, I've heard you talk about Paxton and how in your work you have this test that you do. You hold your work up against to see whether or not it passes or not. And it's called the Paxton test. What exactly is the Paxton test? What does that mean?
If you look at the work of Paxton, so essentially who made glass houses, which then transformed what I believe like 20th century appearance of our cities is based on this structure that he made, glass and iron. I think it's a reason, it's a blueprint for every glass and steel building we have now, and really transformed the way cities look. Concept of inside and outside, transparency, and so on. Shukov, who built kind of diagrid tensile lattice structures, like if you see the Shukov Tower in Moscow, it looks like something that we couldn't even build today. It looks like something from a science fiction movie. It's insane. Kenzo Tange, I mean, you mentioned, I think he's the greatest Japanese architect, completely transformed post-war Japan by, you know, mixing sort of modernity and sort of idea of metabolism. And, you know, he transformed the nation, really, through his work. You know, Ken Yohara I'd also bring to it, who's a designer, but he...
this is the director of Muji, is that right?
Well, Kenya is the art director of Muji, the Japanese home goods brand. But he's also like a philosopher and kind of and writer, you know, who's and a curator and a graphic designer, who's kind of expanded, I think, the way people think about the human senses and about the relationship between kind of material culture and aesthetics and sort of, you know, Japanese-ness and all of this sort of stuff he's explored through his work. But I think all of those people have believe in a bigger question, basically. And they believe that the bigger question can be explored or answered through the work, even if the work is prosaic and sort of mundane and sort of bread and butter. Why not explore the bigger question in everything you do? You know, I think part of the problem is that the question of architecture seems to be about style. Or it seems to be about economy of means, or it seems to be about planning restrictions, and rather it should be about where are human beings going and what kind of species do we want to be. Like it's the fundamental thing, right? Like it's the ant is made by the anthill. In some way, right? What is this ant colony? What is it doing? What is this big picture?
Eva Franchi-Gilbert had a very incisive way, I think, of summing up your work in the context of the presentation you gave at the AA in 2019, where she said something along the lines of, architecture tends to enjoy defining itself in relationship to its own terms, whereas it seems like it's forgotten the relationship between architecture and its subject, which is the spaces between, which is surface, which is volume and texture, and the viewer and the user, and this whole kind of universe of experience on those terms. And I mean, it seems like what she was getting at is exactly what you're describing, that it's a concern with design on a much bigger plane to do with human experience, where we are now and where we're going, how we feel, and how we act and how we behave together. I mean, the interest is so fundamental but so broad that I think it's often hard to kind of articulate it or wrap our head around it. But when we have these historical figures in mind, like Paxton, like Charles and Ray Eames, like Buckminster Fuller, like Kenzo Tange, then we start to remember, I think, what it is that we've forgotten about what architecture was or could be. And so that's why I think in your work and in even just having walked around the studio, there's this sense that we're recovering some of that optimism and that understanding of architecture as being this incredibly expanded field of practice.
I may not phrase this in the right way, but it's helpful sometimes to think that architecture doesn't exist. It's not, it's made up, right? All of this canon and all of this writing and all of the examples and all of the kind of schooling and everything, like, let's just imagine it is all just made up by people, right? It's a religion of some sort. Mm. And you're operating within that religion. But before that religion, there was another religion, or there was another way of thinking about things, right? And so it's about stepping outside of that world and seeing what else is possible, right? Mm. You know, maybe there's multiple gods, right? You know? Maybe we just worship trees. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's all about the stars. And, you know, I think sometimes when you're so in it and you give it a name, it constrains the possibilities. And you, as a creative person, given gifts, right? Like all of us who studied this thing were, it somehow squeezes out the creativity that you were born with. And I just think it's important to try to find a place within, you know, unfortunately, construction industry, within the construction industry, which is really what it is, mm-hmm. for a lot of projects, for that, for creating those new perspectives and the stepping outside of this religion, because we're not going to get anywhere, right? Because all we're doing is the same rituals, the mm-hmm. same mm-hmm. performance, mm-hmm. And really, it doesn't evolve society. It doesn't create. You know, the dream will never happen. Whatever that thing that we hoped for. When people make science fiction movies and present utopian futures about, you know, how we don't get there in the way we're going at the moment. We never get to those places. We sort of just keep doing the same thing, and we run out of resources eventually, mm-hmm. and the species dies off. You know, 99.9% of species on Earth didn't make it, mm-hmm. right? We're this very young species that's about to kill ourselves, and we didn't even fulfill our potential, which is so limitless, and we're making kind of so self-referential. You know, it's a problem. It's easier, and it doesn't get you off. You know, doesn't get you off the planet, or it doesn't get you out of the religion. It doesn't get you kind of to really see where you are. So I think that's part of it. It's like to take a step back, take a breath, and say, what do I really want to do with this creativity that I've got?
This kind of thinking, which is highly speculative, it lends itself so well to the world of expositions, where the structure is temporary, but the ideas persist. And in a way, it kind of sparks a sense of enchantment and optimism and enthusiasm for human potential across nations. And this is a world that you've been working a lot in, but more recently, the focus is shifting to permanent structure and, in a way, a more familiar form of architecture. So we could talk about, for example, the Museum of London. This is, in a way, a major departure, it feels like, for the practice, where you're engaging now in a large-scale architectural project, a renovation of an existing piece of architecture that will be permanent, or at least will last much longer than these expo or exhibition or Olympic pavilion structures might have. And I just wonder how you start to bring this planetary thinking, this cosmic and atomic thinking, this expo thinking into the production of permanent architecture. you're collaborating with Stanton Williams and Julian Harrop, as well as Jane L. Gibbons, joined as a friend of the show. She was on near the very beginning of this project,
I loved
actually.
Her. Yeah.
But in a way, the context feels much more a part of the religion of architecture, or potentially could veer towards that. And so how do you stake out the speculative attitude that you were just describing?
With the Museum of London, for me, the cosmic aspect of it is it's about time. Yeah, so it's about how can a place exist that deals with a 100,000-year-old history, so pre-London, paleobotany, all of that stuff, to a place that's meant to spark our kind of activism and interest in what the city of tomorrow is. Like, the Museum of London has to do all of those things, right? It's an archive, it's also a sort of school in a way, and an agitator and all of this. So for me, it's perfect ground, actually, for dealing with the stuff that I'm interested in. Mm. And the fact that the kind of fourth or fifth collaborator in the process is Horace Jones, who's an architect who died in the 1890s, but whose one of his final buildings was this Smithfield General Market, it's a technical marvel of its day as a sort of machine for selling goods and for being a building that could cope with changing market conditions of the day. Like, it's a very adaptable building. It means that we've been able to create interventions in surgical interventions, so on, which kind of speak about our time, this moment in time, but give possibilities for the future, for future adaptation.
It's so refreshing to be reminded of the inevitable redevelopment of projects that architects work on now. And I think it just doesn't come up enough in the design process. I mean, I've worked a lot on estate regeneration schemes in the past, where we as architects encounter the work of past architects and are intervening and inserting new buildings on council estates. But I think the conversation rarely steers toward what will architects in 50 years do with what we've done? And how do we help them do that, whatever it is they'll do? There's no real, I think, urge to consider the relative transience, I think, of we do as architects now, or the dialogue that the built environment could have with future generations.
Look, let's be honest, all architecture is temporary, right? And I think that's part of the problem, or thing that's led us to so many issues today, is that we forget about that. The thing is constantly in transition. Stuart Brand, another book, was How Buildings Learn, fantastic kind of honest look at architecture and how each generation transforms it and adds their own narrative. And the process of not just demolition, but demolition and reconstruction and historicization and gentrification, appropriation, it's all happens. It's a living story. But all architecture is temporary, which I think changes the way that you think about what you do and why you do it. It's funny to think that some of the building materials that we are used to seeing in the construction industry might only have 10 years of life, and they're specified in buildings that we imagine are going to be around forever. So unless you're building them from stone that's 20 meters thick, the pyramids, your building is going to go in 50 years to 100 years, or 50 to even 20 to 50 years. Mm-hmm. And the changing needs of the city or the site, whatever, it might disappear sooner than that.
I mean, it's interesting that I was intrigued by your social media handles, which are AsifKhan Now. Like, there's this real, I think, real attraction to the present moment, too. And also, this broad question, you mentioned Jack Self is a friend or a collaborator of yours, about what it means to live today. This is a question that his magazine, Real Review, poses quite compellingly. And I mean, it's true. There's a real, I think maybe because of this awareness of deep time, deep historical time and distant future time in the process of design, it also hones one's attention as a designer on the present moment. And I think reinvigorates that question about what it is we're doing here.
Yeah.
What it means to be alive right now.
I mean, we've got relatively short time on this earth as individuals, it's not about legacy or something like that, or the feeling that what you do must stand for years. It's rather that you've helped the next generation think about things differently, or moved things on a bit for them so that they can do interesting things within their lives and so on. And given the fact that this very, very big ship with a million architects on board is moves us towards a certain horizon, it does feel like sort of the taking a moment, take a breath and pause and asking yourself, what should a project be? And is really important, because it does, those small efforts reposition the ship, you know. A little bit of balance or ballast, the moving of ballast or whatever, it changes direction eventually.
Asif, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Scaffold is an Architecture Foundation production. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to AsifKhan. Special thanks this week to Joseph Henry. Thanks as always to Skanda Lin. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.